Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries worldwide over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on A Silence That Screams when we come back. You know, many of the lessons that you hear on the Law Hour are just a small part of our two-week school on courtroom strategy and procedure. And this class includes lessons ranging from what to do and what not to do at the arrest or when you are served with a complaint, a summons, or a citation. And you'll learn how to make a chronology of the names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence, just like the police do. And you'll learn how to conduct a hearing, present evidence, cross-examine witnesses, ask questions, make opening and closing statements, enter exhibits and evidence, and write motions, briefs, affidavits, and asseverations. And I don't just cover what goes on in the courtroom. You'll learn preliminary procedures, arraignments, bail setting, what papers to file, how to put exculpatory evidence into the record, how to present your legal and lawful positions, what issues are appealable, and how to preserve those appealable issues for appellate review. Now, there are 28 essential elements to master in courtroom strategy and procedure, and you'll learn all of them here at the law school in this class. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, then call us here at the law school. It's a place to start. It's the number to call, 417-273-4967. Be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. Now, remember, that's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and it's free of charge. Courtroom Strategy and Procedure is available. That's our school on compact disc for adult home education. And if you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Just click on the email and then send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. All right, we're talking about The Silence That Screams. A student or listener, I'm not quite sure which, wrote in and he said, I began looking for any historical contemporary reports of Jesus after discovering that there is not one word in the Essenes, Dead Sea Scrolls, who would have been the contemporaries of Jesus. So he said, well, can you tell us why it is that 11, 12, 13 of these historians or groups over the past 2,000 years have not mentioned or they don't tell us about Jesus? There's no historical corroboration of the Bible outside of the Bible. And so I answered a couple of those in the last two programs, but he now comes up to Josephus. Now, Josephus was a pretty famous Jewish historian who lived about the time of the Messiah, around 2,000 years ago. In fact, Josephus lived from 37 to 100 A.D., which was just after the Messiah. So he wouldn't have been right there as an eyewitness, but he would have been there, you know, kind of like born a few years after Franklin D. Roosevelt. And so then he was a historian, and he wrote about Jewish law, and he wrote about the Jewish people and one thing and another. Now, the story here begins to take on some intrigue, because Josephus mentions Jesus three times in his 20 books. At least the 20 books that we have. Now, as I mentioned earlier, I don't know if Josephus wrote 21 books, 25 books. We have 20. And I'm not going to read all 20. I have one of Josephus' books over here. It's probably a condensed, edited volume. And I found that it was pretty tedious, but it's probably got some good history in it. Now, remember, the rule on history is this, is that if I came into court and I had a book that's over 30 years old and comes under what we call the ancient documents rule, so if I came in with some documents concerning Brigham Young or Joseph Smith or James K. Polk, you know, or something on that order, written at that time, you know, back in the 1830s or 50s or something, we would take the book at face value. We would presume that the book is true, that the report is true, accurate, and correct. Now, the normal modality would be if you can get two witnesses to agree on a subject matter. Let's take Lewis and Clark's expedition. And you could take some aspect of it, you know, like Seska Jawea, part of the story. And if you could get a separate chronology of that. But you see, in the Lewis and Clark expedition, they were the only ones there. And they kept a journal, they kept a history of their travels and who they met and what they did. And they had the names, dates, times, places, facts, witnesses, and evidence. And we presume that the Lewis and Clark story is true, but let's suppose that the Indians that they came into contact with wrote down some of the specific facts and contradicted Lewis and Clark. We would then have what we call a contested issue of fact. Lewis and Clark say ABC, and let's say the Blackfeet Indians or the Miamis or somebody would write something counter to that, or they might even add something to it. Lewis and Clark might not have written some particular fact, and this Indian tribe or some Indian historian wrote something else. If it contradicts or if it adds to it, we then have two witnesses that are speaking of the same subject. So, in this case here, we're talking about Josephus, who's a pretty prolific writer. He wrote a great deal. And the argument here that the writer that wrote the essay is making is that the statements that he made about Jesus were added to his histories 300 years later. Now, that's not surprising, because there's that, you know, that kind of chicanery goes on all the time. And it isn't just, you know, by religious people, it's by politicians and economists. Right now, today, the numbers that we're getting out of our government are lies. They're not all lies. They're just some lies. But it's just not all true. And these lies are being written to affect history. History is a series of lies written by liars. And about the only way that you can come to a consensus of truth is when you get two or three historians that agree to the same facts. At the mouth of two witnesses or at the mouth of three witnesses shall the matter be established. Now, the Bible is about one-third history. So it's about one-third prophecy, about one-third history, and about one-third law. Now, I got to ask the question, why is it that Pliny and Aristotle and Josephus are good historians, but Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are bad historians? Where did that concept come from? What makes the histories of Clement, Tertullian, or Jerome any more valid, any more trustworthy than Isaiah, Jeremiah, or Ezekiel? And I think we have some biases here. And those biases ought to be explored. Somebody ought to say, well, hang on a second. I'm not really sure that Josephus is going to write a history about Jesus. I mean, think about it pragmatically. Why would Michael Beschloss write a history about World War II? He might mention World War II in passing. He might make observations. I do. I'm a legal historian, and I write treatises, and I write papers that deal with law. I write about the Ten Commandments. I write about Article 1, Section 10 of our Constitution. I write about legal precedents that were decided back in 1867 or in 1878, and then I make commentaries on them. I rely upon the historical sources such as the United States Supreme Court reports. Now, is the United States Supreme Court reports true, accurate, and correct, or has it been buggered up? I don't know. I wasn't there. I wasn't at the trial. I can't tell you any more than what is being reported by the reporter at the time. But you know, we get reports today of contemporary events that are going on right now in Iraq. And our government tells us one thing, and then the news media tells us something else, and sometimes the news media will report on something, and then they shut up about it. Let me give you an illustration. Remember when the Twin Towers were knocked down, September 11th? Well, the guy that owned those towers, his name is Silverman. Silverman was interviewed on that day or the next day. And there was a building there, a 42-story building. It was called Building 7. And it had some damage done to it from the collapse of the Twin Towers. But it was a 42-story building. I mean, it was a humongous steel and concrete building. And Silverman said, as to its collapse, he said, well, we ordered it pulled. Now, the term, we ordered it pulled, is a term that is used by demolition people or experts or people in the business when they go to blow up a building and it falls straight down into the basement of the building. Now, in order to wire one of those buildings up for demolition, takes about 6 weeks to 3 months to wire one up. Depends on the size of the building and where it's located and so on. But that building, remember, was a sneak attack that occurred on September 11th. There wasn't enough time to wire that building for the explosion, for the demolition, in the few hours especially, when the building was on fire, and especially during all the chaos that was going on there at the Trade Tower site. And yet the news media to this day is totally silent about Silverman's or Silverstein's statement that he ordered the building pulled. Or they, that is the fire department, ordered it pulled. There wasn't enough time to wire it. So therefore it had to have been wired for demolition long before September the 11th. Which now lends credibility to the story that's now being put out by a lot of different sources now concerning the demolition of the two Trade Tower buildings. Now, that's history that all of us lived through. We're right here, right now. And there's deception going on right now. There was deception at the Kennedy assassination. There's the official story, and then there's the reason, logic, and common sense story. All right, so here's my point. History is not all truth. History is written from the perspective of the historian. It's written, in some cases, dependent upon the perspective of the government in power. Let's talk about governments in power. Right now, today, if I wanted to write a history, I wanted to write a story concerning the Holocaust in Germany, I would be walking on very, very thin ice. Many countries have enacted laws that make it illegal for you to deny the Holocaust. Those are called Holocaust deniers. Now, history ought to be the truth. It ought to be a story about what happened and who the characters were, and it should be totally unbiased. It ought to be just the facts, ma'am, as old Joe Friday used to say, you know, just the facts. But it isn't, and it hasn't been, and it isn't likely to be in the future. History oftentimes is influenced by government policy. For instance, in World War II, for instance, it was kept secret that our president, Franklin Roosevelt, knew about the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor at least a week in advance, if not months, at least a week in advance. And yet he did nothing, and he did nothing because he wanted the Japanese to attack so that he could get America into the war on the side of the Allies. Now, that being the case, you know, you can sit here and argue about it. Well, did he know or didn't he know? Well, at the time, you know, the official government story was that he did not know. Today, after all of the classified information, you know, has been released, and most of the people that were involved in that historical period of time are now dead and buried. I can remember my granddad believed that the Germans sunk the Lusitania and they were a bunch of dirty Huns, and that it was an unarmed passenger vessel. 50 years after the fact, in 1967, they released the manifest that the Lusitania was carrying arms. America was claiming to be a neutral country, and we weren't. We were on Britain's side, and we were supplying arms to Britain, and they were shipping them over there on these passenger liners. Very, very common practice. And the Germans found out about it, and they said, well, in fact, the Germans were pretty big about it. They took out 5 ads in 5 major newspapers and said, you Americans don't ride on that ship. And if you do and we catch it out on the high seas, we're going to sink it because it's carrying arms. Manufactured from Fort Wayne, Indiana. All right, now, these intrigues go on in history. History is a system, then, of lies that is corroborated by the government, or in the case of today, actually mandated by government. So, if you were to write something that was contrary to the official Holocaust story, you can be prosecuted and jailed for doing that. I don't think that history is any different. I don't think that time is any different. I don't think governments are any different today than they were 2,000 years ago. Now, the reason for that is to get the people of a country to believe something. It's a common practice, been going on forever. And we do not want the truth known, at least at this juncture of time. We don't want the truth known. And so we will enact laws. We will lock people up in jail. We will bend the news. We will bend the history as we deem or as we see fit. So let's read this story here. It's about Josephus. Josephus was not a contemporary and could not have been a first-hand eyewitness of Jesus. However, as a Jewish historian who focused on Jewish history and religion, he would have been greatly interested in the appearance of the Jewish Messiah. Josephus wrote The Antiquities of the Jews. See his works here, and he gives a website. This is a work that focused on Jewish history from Adam to Josephus' time. And yet, while Josephus devotes a great deal or a good deal of time and space to John the Baptist and other historical figures mentioned in the Gospels, he gives a detailed account of Pontius Pilate in the Jewish Wars. He does not appear to have actually written anything at all concerning the life of Jesus. This is damning, considering that we would expect that the appearance of the Jewish Messiah ought to have dominated a work dedicated to Jewish history. Okay, I'm going to pause right there and make an observation. The Pharisees, of which Josephus was one, and the Apostle Paul was one, they were working as hard as they could to cancel out the works of the Messiah. They denied that he was there. I read to you yesterday a passage here in the scripture in John chapter 7 where the Pharisees, the rulers, said, have any of the rulers believed on him? There isn't any reason at all for Josephus to write anything about Jesus. And as I pointed out, what we do in history is we ignore him. If there's something that we don't believe or that we don't accept, we ignore it. We don't write about it. Now, that's what we do today. That's what I do. And I'm not here to make, as I pointed out, the case for the Mormons. The Mormons have to make their own case. And so they're out here. They write their own histories. They write their own literature. And they go out and they espouse it. And they preach it. And they propagandize about it. So do the Catholics. And so do the Baptists. And so to make an argument from ignorance it violates the tenets or the principles of adjudication. For instance, if I wanted to prove a fact in court, I would come in with testimony. I'd walk in with a witness, and I'd say, here's the witness's testimony. Then I would bring in whatever documentation that I could get to support that witness, and then the other side would cross-examine that witness and try to trip him up. It's called the Kwok Ting test. What we need is two or three witnesses who can testify to a fact. Now, in the Bible, which is a historical book, and Moses was a historian, Moses wrote a lot of history. The history of the Garden of Eden, for instance, the only source for the creation account in the Garden of Eden is the Bible. I don't know that the Koran has that story in it. I don't know that the Buddhists or anybody else has that historical record. So the Bible is a pretty good historical book. It tells us about many of the wars that went on back in very ancient times. It tells us who the leaders were, who the names of the people were, kings of Sodom and Gomorrah and the things like that. It tells us a story, for instance, of the Philistines and so on, that we wouldn't ordinarily have in secular history. We might or we might not. It's a pretty good historical book. It has, up until recent times, been accepted as a historical book. But now we have what we call higher criticism, and this is one of those examples of higher criticism using an argument from ignorance, as I pointed out last time. Now, furthermore, Josephus was interested both in the concept of the resurrection as well as the histories of various Jewish sects, which a real Jesus would have either, one, been a member of, Jesus wasn't a member of any religious sect or organization. Remember, he was the Messiah. He was God incarnate. He came here to teach us his law, his religious ideology, not to join the Catholics, the Baptists, or the Mormons. Let me ask you this. Do you think that if Jesus came back today that he would join the Mormon church? Mormons would all say, of course he would. Would he join the Catholic Church? Well, the Catholics would all say, well, of course he would. Excuse me. I don't think that makes a lot of sense. If the Creator himself came back, don't you think that he would form his own church, which is what the Messiah did and the Bible reports on? He created his own, totally separate. He was at odds with every religious organization. He called them liars. He called them whitened sepulchers. He called them everything but a white man. Now, do you think that he was going to get any good press out of Josephus, a Pharisee? It is surprising that he didn't get bad press. I think it would make more logic to say Josephus should have written a lot about Jesus, and it should have been negative. He should have said, what a liar, what a charlatan, what a fraud. And the fact that he gave him the silent treatment, which is the other way that we handle people that we don't agree with. It's either one, you attack them and you tell what liars they are, or you ignore them and pretend that they don't exist. That's the two ways that you deal with opposition in history. So he would not have been a member of, I would take exception to that. There he says, number two, he would have had substantial discourse with. How could a man with these experiences and with these interests not have dedicated volumes to Jesus if there were any reason to believe such a Messiah existed? Listen, the Pharisees at the time did not believe that he was the Messiah. That was the crux of the whole argument. Everywhere in the New Testament where there is a report about his miracles, about his ministry, this is the Messiah now, the Jews rejected him, the Pharisees rejected him. In fact, they were so vehement about the fear, they were so fearful that he was going to take market share out of their churches that they killed him. And so this argument here that's being made is exactly counter to the scripture. Now, there's a contested issue of fact here. This is a he said, she said. So he doesn't say that Josephus said that Jesus lied. In fact, in the entire treatise here that I'm reporting on, there isn't any direct statements here that say that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John were lying, or that there is a contested issue here. His basic premise here is that if this Jesus had existed, if Jesus had done all these things, surely these eminent historians of the day would have commented upon it. How many historians today are commenting upon Franklin D. Roosevelt's knowledge of the attack on Pearl Harbor? How many historians today, or indeed contemporary news writers, are writing about Silverstein's admission that Building 7 was pulled, it was blown up deliberately by the fire department, and they ordered it destroyed on 9/11, which would have taken 6 weeks to wire? That building was wired for demolition at least 6 weeks before 9/11. Doesn't that kind of tell you then that 9/11 was a false flag operation? But the official history is that no, it was these terrorists that attacked us, and they've got this story, and they're sticking with it. They can't change it. And because they can't change it, they're sticking with the story. And, of course, they use silence. There's plenty of history out here. There's plenty of people writing about 9/11. There's a whole underground press. There are dozens of publications and films and archives. There's no shortage of information out here concerning 9/11 or Silverstein and Building 7 and the Pentagon, you know, with the cameras and et cetera, and no parts of the airplane coming out. You know, the official part, this is the dumbest part of the whole thing. You got a 757 running into the Pentagon. The Pentagon isn't totally destroyed. The Pentagon actually has superficial damage on one side of it over here. And not a single airplane part comes out of the building. And yet the official story is that it was hit by a 57. Guy got real nasty with me. He said, well, if that wasn't the case, then what happened to the people on the airplane? Hell, I don't know. I can't sit here and tell you that I know everything about the Pentagon or 9/11, but I can listen to somebody's story and I can pick it apart. I mean, come on, guys. If an airplane crashes, the other day as I speak, there was an airplane crashed over in Thailand. And that's a big event, you know, when an airplane crashes, they want the black boxes and they want to know, well, what happened and so on, one thing and another. You know, there are parts of the airplane. I mean, the airplane parts don't disappear just because it crashes into a building. And so if a 757 hit the Pentagon, there ought to be some pieces. At least the engines are steel. You know, the engines didn't melt. There ought to be aluminum, melted aluminum, if nothing else, if you're telling me that the fire was so hot it burned everything up. In the trade towers, those two airplanes, you know, that hit them over there, the engines went right through the buildings. They got the engines out. I mean, they could identify the type of airplane. And we had the videotape of the airplanes hitting the buildings. Well, there was a videotape of the, oh, whatever it was that hit the Pentagon. Down the street, there was a gas station. And they had a surveillance camera. It was aimed right at the Pentagon. The FBI came in and they seized the camera and they seized the film, just like they did the Zagruder tapes of the John F. Kennedy assassination. And from that point on, once the FBI gets it, hey, the rest of us can't see it. Now, that's history that's being doctored. History is a controlled lie. But they don't lie to you all the time. Because remember, if they lied to us all the time, we'd always know the truth. So they have to lie to you and then mix it with the truth, and then they deceive us. Now, that's what deception's all about. The Bible is a counterbalance to history. So I look at the scripture and I say, okay, well, here's the story, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Is there any corroboration by anybody else? If there isn't any corroboration, it doesn't tell me that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are false anymore. Then if there's no corroboration of Lewis and Clark, does not tell us the Lewis and Clark journals are false. Surely, if the Lewis and Clark expedition was true, there would be some contemporaneous Indian stories about it. And there may be, but I haven't seen them published. And just because it hasn't been published by the Indians doesn't mean that it is true or isn't true. And it doesn't mean that everything that Lewis and Clark wrote in their journals is necessarily true either. I mean, you know, if there was something that Lewis and Clark came across and they wanted to create a different impression, or they wanted to create a different part of the story, they would have just written it down that way. That's what your government does today. If there's something they want you to believe, they just write it down and put it out there. Tell you what they want you to believe, like the Gulf of Tonkin, the battleship Maine. Remember how the Spanish blew up the battleship Maine? Years later, there was an article came out in the National Geographic, and they went out to the Maine. They took a look at the pieces. They used forensic evidence. They used modern science, and they took a look at it and said that explosion didn't occur from the outside, which is the story we were told in 1898, which was the justification for getting into war with Spain so that we could take their colonies, the Philippines and Cuba and the Virgin Islands and so on, Puerto Rico. But rather, it was an explosion from the inside of the ship. Now, that's the forensic facts. But in 1898, you know, under the political administration, they said, oh, it was the Spanish that blew up our ship in Havana Harbor, and therefore we need to go to war. Now, all of the people that were involved in that back in 1898 are dead and buried today. Those of us are sitting here and say, well, okay, well, what's the big deal? So, you know, that war was a long time ago, so our government lied to us. That's what that boils down to. And it's not the only time our government's lied to us. Our government lies to us constantly. Now, most people don't believe that, but those are the hard facts of life. That's what the bald-faced truth is. I contend that the Bible, and I'm going to show this, I'm going to take on the burden. I'm going to show the Bible has better evidence for the veracity of the historical events in the Scripture than does Josephus. Not that Josephus isn't a good historian, but I think we got better historians and better writers in the Creator of the universe using Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John as scribes and telling us what actually happened, as opposed to the politically motivated and religiously motivated historians of the day. I don't think that a historian, let's just take let's think about it pragmatically. I don't think that a Catholic historian is going to give us the truth about the Mormon Church. And I don't think that a Mormon historian is going to give us all the truth about the Catholic Church. I think it's going to be one-sided. I think it's going to be warped. An old guy told me one time, he says, if you want to know what the Catholics believe, don't go to a Baptist, go to a Catholic. He'll tell you what he believes. And if you want to know what the Baptists believe, do not go to a Catholic, go to a Baptist. He will tell you what he believes. So I think that the better source of what did Jesus believe, what did he practice, what did he teach, would come from Jesus' own words in Jesus' own history, rather than his enemies, his political and his religious opponents, who were opposed to him at the time and who are opposed to him to this day. The Jews have never had a good word about the Messiah in 2,000 years. They don't today. They didn't then. I don't think that it should be surprising to us that either he's gotten the short end of the stick, or he's been lied about, or ignored. Hey, we'll be back with more on Josephus here and the silence that screams right after this. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the law school and The Law Hour, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, biblical law, from the scriptural perspective. And the law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and we are open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, then please go to our homeschooling page on our website. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has our radio log schedule and archives that can be accessed through the website as well. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. And the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do it 7 days a week. The law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the law school at 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events. And the sources of this information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief. The Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. These endorsements or recommendations that we give do not mean that the authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. Now, that's because most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be hostile. They may be political or religious or economic or sectarian. They could be racial. They can be ethnic partisans whose viewpoint is not totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or local radio station. If you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, then please go to our website. It's georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we are reviewing A Silence That Screams. Now, there's about two pages here written about Josephus, and I'm going to agree with the author that the Christians, and when we talk about Christians in the third century, we're talking about the Roman Catholic Church, came in and added into Josephus' work the story that they put in here about Jesus. I wouldn't doubt that for a minute. I wouldn't doubt it for a minute. The Catholic Church has had a long history of that kind of chicanery, and I'm not here to defend Christians or Christianity or the Roman Catholics or anybody else. But I think that the Bible gets a bad rap because the Christians give it a bad rap. I pointed this out to you earlier. I said the Bible didn't say the earth was flat. That was the Christians that said the earth was flat. It was the Roman Catholic Church. And the Christians are divided up into, in this country, 476 incorporated and sectarian and political groups. And they incorporate and they get 501c3 tax exemption and so on down the line. Well, they've got an axe to grind. Those are government churches, and they preach the government line. You don't get the truth out of church. You don't get the truth out of government. You don't get the truth out of the Department of Labor. You get what they want you to get. They get what they want you to believe. So, for that reason, when we're talking about these ancient historians, hell, the historians of today are liars. Katie Couric is a contemporary historian. Every night on the news, she is reporting the news. She's reporting history as it occurs. And oftentimes, they omit stories. They don't tell you anything about it. They just treat it with ignorance. They treat it with silence. Sometimes, they will attack it head on and they'll make fun of it and call you a conspiracy theorist. Oh, you're one of those conspiracy theorists, eh? The answer to that is yes, I am. I don't deny. I do not believe everything that government and religion and politics tells me. I think they're lying a lot of the time. An old guy told me one time, he said, you know, when it comes to this conspiracy theory and we're talking about international geopolitics, he said, there has to be a conspiracy because if there wasn't a conspiracy, then the foreign policy of the United States once in a while would work out in our favor just by accident, and it never does. So that old this old guy said to me, he said, therefore it has to be contrived. There's no other answer. All right, so now there's the Josephus story, and I'm going to concede that it's probably true. And he goes on with quite a little story here, and I think that he's probably hit the nail right on the head when he says that the Christians came in and took Josephus' work. If that's the case, then Josephus never said a word about Jesus and kept the silence then perfect. He wrote 20 books, and I pointed this out. What we do not have from these pagan philosophers and these pagan historical writers, we don't have all of their works. And he points out that there was one writer in here, and he said, of all of the works that we have from Pliny or from Jerome or Aristotle, etc., they never mentioned Jesus one time. And I'm sitting here saying, well, do you have all of Pliny's works? I think the answer to that is going to be no. Or we don't know. Well, then we don't know whether Pliny wrote about Jesus because we don't have all of his work. And so, again, this is an argument from ignorance. Yesterday I used the word stupidity. Because if we took this argument into court, we'd be laughed out. You can't walk into court with an argument from ignorance. You have to walk in, and the burden of going forward is on you. The burden of going forward is on this guy here to prove that the biblical historical account is false. And not a single one of these historical writers of the past have contradicted the Bible. He didn't make that case at all, which is the correct case. Let me give you an illustration. Let's suppose that you and I are at loggerheads here, and you sue me. And you come into court. The burden of going forward is on you to write a complaint against me and tell the court all of the bad things that I've done. And so you come in and you say, George Gordon is a dirty, no good, low life, and he did all these bad things over here, and for that I want damages. I want him to pay me money. So I come in and I answer your complaint. And in some cases I say, well, I agree with the plaintiff. I did do that. I agree, I did enter into a contract with him. I agree, I did deliver these goods and services to him. And he claims these goods are shoddy, or that they're bad goods or whatever. All right, so I answer your complaint. That's because the burden shifts to me. All right, this burden of going forward shifts back and forth. And in this series of programs, I'm going to take my burden. I'm going to take the Bible. I'm going to defend the Bible. I think the Bible has true, accurate, and correct history to it, and I think I can prove that. But I'm not going to argue from ignorance. I'm going to argue my facts with witnesses, evidence, and testimony. See, this author, in his treatise, he says, the Christians say that we just accept the Bible, we accept this, and that's all that needs to be said. And I pointed this out before, that may be good theology, but it's bad history. And I agree with the author here that he wants more, he wants proof. And I think he's entitled to proof. But the proof doesn't come from pagan historical sources who have ignored the history of this particular man, this particular individual, this God that we call Jesus. I think that the Bible can make a better case for itself and prove its own veracity rather than going to its enemies to prove the veracity of it. I don't think it's logical for me to go to the Mormon Church to prove Roman Catholicism or any points thereof. I don't think that that's logical at all. And I wouldn't expect the Catholics to write any good words about the Mormons. I don't think they have. I don't think that they are. I don't think that they're going to. The Mormons have to make their own case. All right. Now, he's got more to say. Now, that was the Josephus story. He goes on here. He says, Justus of Tiberius and Dio Chrysostom, or Chrysostom, and Epictetus, E-P-I-C-T-E-T-U-S, they all should have noticed, and it appears that none did. I put the name Michael Beschloss here. Michael Beschloss is a historian, a contemporary historian, a presidential historian, and he writes about presidents. He could, if he wanted to, write about the Civil War. I don't know if he does or doesn't or hasn't. I haven't written or read any of Beschloss's stories, but he's on the NewsHour quite often, and he seems to be a pretty knowledgeable guy. And he comes on there and he says, well, here's what the story is concerning these presidents and one thing and another. And Michael Beschloss has a specialty, and his specialty is writing about presidents. And from what I have observed from historians is that they will specialize. Ken Burns specializes in war and the Civil War and World War II and so on. And that because they specialize in that, it would not be surprising to me that you could read the entirety of Ken Burns' historical references and never find any political diatribe on George Washington. Surely if George Washington had existed, a historian of the stature of Ken Burns would have written about it. Now, he probably has written something about the Revolutionary War. But let's take another president that wasn't involved in war, you know, like James K. Polk. Well, he was involved in the Mexican War. I guess we'll have to find another one over here. Let's try Grover Cleveland. So, you know, if somebody didn't write a story about Grover Cleveland, you know, if Ken Burns didn't write about Grover Cleveland, I don't think that would be surprising. I don't think it'd be surprising at all. Now, remember that there's more than one way to discredit a history or a story. You can attack the story head on, which is what I would have expected. For instance, let's suppose that we've got this story going around in the time of Josephus, or just after Josephus, about Jesus and all these miracles. I mean, you've got thousands of people over here now that are following this new religious ideology that we call Christianity today. And the Pharisees are working hard to stamp it out. They're trying to eradicate it. We've done that here in the United States. You know, the anarchy movement of the 1800s, the union movements of the late 19th century. Government worked hard to stamp that out. You saw it at Waco. Government came in and stamped out that religious ideology at Waco. So when you get crosswise with your government, you know, the government will come in and use the law against you and stamp you out. It's been that way forever. And I suspect it's going to continue to be that way. Now, he goes on to say, but how shall we excuse the supine inattention of the pagan and philosophic world to those evidences which were represented by the hand of omnipotence? Not to their reason, but to their senses. During the age of Christ, of his apostles, and of their first disciples, the doctrine which they preached was confirmed by innumerable prodigies. The lame walked, the blind saw, the sick were healed, the dead were raised, demons were expelled, and the laws of nature were frequently suspended for the benefit of the church. But the sages of Greece and Rome turned aside from the awful spectacle and, pursuing the ordinary occupations of life and study, appeared unconscious of any alterations in the moral or physical government of the world. Under the reign of Tiberius, the whole earth, or at least a celebrated province of the Roman Empire, was involved in a darkness of 3 hours. Even this miraculous event, which ought to have excited the wonder, the curiosity, and the devotion of mankind, passed without notice in an age of science and history. Excuse me, that was an age of science and history when people believed the world was flat? And that health came from cow's dung rubbed in your hair? You call that an era of science? No, I call that an era of pagan superstition. Now, that's my observation of it. If you think that that was an era of science and wonder, well, that's your choice. I mean, these people were still letting blood. You know, George Washington was bled to death. These people here 200 years ago here in the United States, for crying out loud, weren't at the pinnacle of science and technology. Well, it happened during the lifetime of science, and the elder Pliny, who must have. Well, that's an opinion. I'm going to pause right there. Excuse me. This author here in his treatise is offering a lot of opinion, and opinions are not accepted in court unless they're by an expert. And I pointed out to you the other day that all experts are liars. An expert witness is just a paid professional liar who comes into court to testify on his specialty in life. If I come into court and I call an expert witness who's going to come in and testify, the other side brings in another expert witness who comes in and testifies to exactly the opposite in the same science or discipline. They both can't be right. But one testifies to ABC and the other one testifies to XYZ. So, you know, you got to take that with a grain of salt. That's what the bottom line is. Now, when you're using terms here like who must have, you know, common sense would say, and in some cases I'll agree with him, you know, when he comes in, he says, now, these Christians, or whoever, I don't know if it was Christians that came in and doctored Josephus's books. It could have been the pagan Roman Empire. It could have been, you know, it could have been some political or some religious or some economic group or somebody else. I don't know. I don't think he knows who did it either. But was it done? I think probably it was, because it's pretty common practice. Pretty common practice. In fact, today we have government sitting here making laws that if you were to write about certain subjects, you know, like hate crimes and historical revisionism and so on, I mean, they'll put you in jail for that. And that's been pretty common. That's historically correct. That's historical. You know, many writers have written about that and complained about it. And then, of course, years later, you know, the truth comes out. But who must have experienced the immediate effects or received the earliest intelligence of the prodigy, each of these philosophers in a laborious work has recorded all of the great phenomena of nature, earthquakes, meteors, comets, eclipses, which has indefatigable curiosity could collect. Both the one and the other have omitted to mention the greatest phenomenon to which the mortal eye has been witness or has seen since the creation of the world. Could the most amazing event ever go unnoticed? Only the intellectually dishonest can answer with yes. Well, I guess I'm intellectually dishonest. I will have to confess then that if that's the case, I am intellectually dishonest, because I can sit here and say yes. Hell, it's going on all around us today. And that's why I've been saying, I said, I don't think that you can go to the United States government to get the truth about 9/11. It is correct that the United States government has told us some true facts concerning 9/11, and they have mixed those true facts with some error, with some deliberate lies, and then we have a perception of what happened there. Could the most amazing event ever go unnoticed? Well, now, a very amazing event, Building 7, was blown up right in front of your eyeballs, boys and girls. And then the owner of the buildings, Mr. Silverstein, admitted that he had ordered the building pulled at 5 o'clock. And then the cameras show the building perfectly imploding and falling straight down. It was exploded. And yet you've been told that was done by terrorists. Now, you people saw the damage to the Pentagon right in front of your eyeballs. You saw it reported on ABC and CBS and NBC. And not a single airplane part's ever been pulled out of the Pentagon. And the guy says, well, you know, if you deny that, then you had to be intellectually dishonest. Well, I guess that's the badge I got to wear. I'm a conspiracy theorist, and I believe in the conspiracy theory. And there's a few million other people out there that believe the same thing. Now, that doesn't make us right, and it doesn't make us wrong. You know, if the conspiracy theory of history is not true, then I'm in error. That's all. I made a mistake. And it won't be my first one. But if, on the other hand, you know, I try to pay attention to history, I try to pay attention to what's going on around me, and then I see Building 7, you know, I watched the Nova story as the trade towers, you know, collapsed. They put a program on. I believed it. I thought, well, that's what happened. The thing got hot and the steel warped and melted, and then the buildings fell down. That's what I thought I was seeing. And then I saw another story. When I saw the other story, I said, oh my God, I saw that right in front of my eyeballs, and I believed the government story, and it was a lie. I don't believe that those buildings fell down from the heat. I believe that they were blown down. That those buildings were blown up floor by floor all the way to the bottom. Those two buildings fell 100 stories in 9 seconds. And then here's the story on that. If those buildings had pancaked, it would have taken a minute for them to fall down. Not 9 seconds. They free fell. And to do that, you got to blow up what's underneath them. Because if it falls down on the next floor, it'll hold there for a second, and then it'll go down for another one, and hold there for a second, and then on down, it pancakes. And they've showed some pictures of buildings that have pancaked and how long it takes them to fall. All right, so with that out of the way, I'm about out of time, so I'm going to have to wrap this up. And then we're going to take the balance of this story next time. And the guy's making a good argument here. I'm not arguing with his argument. His argument is incorrect. And a lot of times you'll come into court with a good argument, which is legally incorrect. And then you lose your case. That doesn't mean that you are dumb or that you had a bad argument. It just means that it wasn't true, accurate, and correct. Didn't quite meet the test, the Kwok Ting test, for instance. And then I want to come back and I want to take up the scripture, and I want to take a look at the scripture and the history. I think that Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John are just as good of historians as is Justus of Tiberius, or Epicurus, or Pliny, or Josephus. I think that the Bible is just as true, accurate, and correct as any of these pagan philosophers. And if you take exception to that, could you tell me why? What would make you believe that these stories are incorrect? All right. So with that out of the way, let me give you a final reminder here that you have been listening to the Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now remember, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the internet daily. And for more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, then please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. All right, we are about out of time, so I'm going to have to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.